Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Please join me in welcoming Phyllis Schlafly.
They say that women are like tea bags. You don't know their strength until they get into hot water.
We need to talk about the threat of the women's liberation movement. So let me be clear. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. What I am against is a small, elitist group putting down homemakers. They want to create a sex-neutral society, which will mean that women are going to find themselves with two full-time jobs. So you need to tell your senators you want them to vote no on this Equal Rights Amendment, so we can have a country that we are proud to leave our daughters.
Hello and welcome back to the second episode of Still Watching Mrs. America. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
So right now we are in a funky little time in Still Watching where we are covering the end of Westworld and beginning of Mrs. America. So this is the second episode we're recording covering Mrs. America, but we are talking about the fourth episode of the Mrs. America season titled Betty. So if you're not caught up to the episode titled Betty, episode 4, which should be available for you, FX on Hulu, you might want to press pause and catch up. But our first episode that we recorded last week covered episodes 1 through 3.
And that was Fred, Barney, Wilma. And now we're on Betty.
Alice, Ted. Yes. yeah. So we covered those episodes last week. We have a little bit more space this week to go a little bit more in depth in the episode since we don't have to cram 3 episodes worth of discussion into one podcast episode. We can spend a more leisurely episode discussing Betty and everything that happens therein. Just in case you're joining us for the first time, what we do when still watching is we break down the latest episode of some television show that we're watching kind of obsessively right now. We are currently obsessed Mrs. America. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, corrections — we didn't get any corrections last week, but also we didn't have a chance to say much last week — you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback. I'd also love to hear from people's experiences. One of the coolest things I ever did to learn about sort of the feminist movement at this time is when I was in my early 20s, I was in a book club with a bunch of my friends from the same age, and then one of my friends' mom and like all of her friends. So it's this, you know, dual generational book club. I know it was a very cool early 20 something to be in this book club, but we read Joan Didion's White Album, and there was actually like kind of this angry argument between the generations about, you know, feminism and what the younger generation takes for granted and stuff like that. And it's this conversation that is always stuck with me. So I'd love to get some feedback from folks who are maybe a little older than Richard and I are and who lived this movement and were on the ground and have some firsthand experience that we are, you know, completely ignorant about. And I would love to hear from people younger than us who are coming to some of this maybe with even fresher eyes than we have. And I'd love to hear from everyone. So stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. On this episode of the podcast, we will be hearing from two actresses from the show. We have interviews with Rose Byrne, who plays Gloria Steinem, and Tracy Ullman, who plays Betty Friedan. So you will hear from both of them later on in this episode. But first, Richard, you and I are going to talk about Betty. I loved this episode. I mean, I've loved every episode that I've watched so far, but there is so much going on in this episode, and it starts with this really smart frame. Well, it starts with the historical framework is January 1973 and Roe v. Wade. And that being this big step forward in this movement, in this fight, particularly as it pertains to Gloria Steinem, you know, who we explored in the episode Gloria. You know, how does this land for you, Richard, this immediate historical, like huge seminal historical context for this episode?
I mean, it's interesting because it's such a big deal and it's something that is still being, you know, bitterly fought over now. And it's not an afterthought in this episode, but it's just kind of the backdrop because this whole season is about the ERA versus the fight specifically in the courts with Roe v. Wade. But it's just crazy to think, you know, I think in an earlier episode, it's in the lead up to the 1972 presidential election, and you hear about Watergate happening, and you're like, right, Watergate, the break-in happened before the election, and then Nixon was reelected. And to think that the ERA was being fought for while Roe v. Wade is, you know, in the courts, like, it's just crazy, like, how much history was happening at the same time, I guess, because I think, you know, from the lens of the present day, it can seem like it's all plotted neatly on a timeline where everything had its own discrete moment. And, you know, they informed each other these events, but they weren't happening, you know, concurrently. And yet here we are getting that exact, you know, scene.
Right. And so that's sort of the span we're looking at. We're looking at January 1973, and then the debate that happened at in Illinois was May 1973. So that's sort of like the time frame that we're dealing with here. And the other sort of cultural framing, the really smart cultural framing for this episode is it opens with Betty Friedan and her friend Natalie, played by the great Miriam Shore, watching an episode of Mary Tyler Moore. I watched so much Mary Tyler Moore growing up. Did you watch Mary, Richard?
That was not one of my household shows. No, I mean, I was into shows of that era, particularly the Brady Bunch, which was a much more, let's say, cleaned up version of that time and place. But I have gone back and seen episodes as a grown up, and it was such a sharp, you know, show for any era, but particularly that era, you know, with the women's lib movement really reaching a kind of zenith. It feels like maybe it wasn't on purpose part of that movement, but definitely became an emblem of it. I mean, just even like the theme song.
One of my favorite stories around the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and this is relevant to the entire episode, is that Mary Tyler Moore, the actress, was, before she had her own show, Mary Tyler Moore, she was on the Dick Van Dyke Show. She played Laura, Rob's husband, on the Dick Van Dyke Show. So she was like, she's a sitcom wife. And then this new show that came on after the Dick Van Dyke Show is over, you know, she gets her own show and she's playing Mary. And the original premise for the Mary Tyler Moore Show was that Mary was a freshly divorced woman coming to the city to, you know, to try to support herself and start a career. And the network brass at the time insisted that, she not be a divorcee because they were afraid that American audiences would think she had divorced Dick Van Dyke. And so they were like, even though Laura Petrie and Mary Richards are two different people, they were like, America won't like it. She can't be a divorcee. She has to be like a single woman. So she wound up like a, you know, an older single woman. And,
it's like the Brady Bunch, how they couldn't have the parents be divorced. So they're both, you know, a widow and a widower.
Widows.
And they never address the fact that these kids have like lost a parent. Each.
That's what they're never mentioned.
It's never mentioned.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's true. But the big framing device of the episode is this idea of like Mary Tyler Moore and then her friend Rhoda Morgenstern, played by the great Valerie Harper. And like, Valerie Harper is this gorgeous woman, but at the time it's this idea that like Mary is this like, you know, glamorous, waspy single, and that, you know, Rhoda Morgenstern is this like, you know, Jewish, like quote unquote, like, more desperately single friend of hers, which is ridiculous when you look at Valerie Harper. And then eventually Rhoda was so popular, she gets her own show in, 1978. But at this point, she's still Mary's upstairs neighbor. And there's this great moment at the beginning of the episode when Betty points out, she's like, oh yeah, no, Mary never goes to Rhoda's apartment. And it's just this whole dichotomy of like, okay, Gloria Steinem is the Mary and Betty is the Rhoda. And that's the roles that they've been assigned, in this movement. And, I just thought that that was a really clever way to frame what will become this episode long, season long conflict between these women.
Well, and movement long. I mean, you know, I think that it's interesting to see these things happen in, the show's version of real time. You know, these kind of intra movement conflicts and, the idea of, you know, okay, well, this older generation helped, but how much do we listen to them and how much do we kind of pay them, you know, reverence, but because some of their ideas are a little bit fustier and crustier than ours are, you know, I think people now would say that about Gloria Steinem. And so I think it's good and important that the show is introducing or further exploring that kind of, you know, half generational dialogue, where, you know, I see that a lot, you know, in the gay rights movement now, where, a lot of people don't seem to appreciate exactly how we got to the point we are, while at the same time, it's important to recognize that we think about things differently than, you know, people in the movement did 40 years ago.
Exactly. And I mean, the micro generational aspect of Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, like, because the feminine mystique comes out in the 60s and, you know, we're right at the beginning of the 70s. So it's only been a few years. And yet Betty Friedan is relegated to like mother of the movement, a phrase that she roundly rejects, obviously. But yeah, this whole idea, I've been trying to like sort of, you know, bone up on some supplemental material. And I was watching this great documentary that's on, HBO from a few years ago, called, Gloria in Her Own Words, the 2011, Gloria Steinem documentary. And, Gloria Steinem, you know, in that documentary is talking about how, you know, the perception of the women's movement and the show has already, you know, touched on this several times, perception of the women's movement, and not just the second wave feminists, but the suffragettes is that, you know, they are like musty, fusty, like desperate women who can't get a man. And so they've, you know, they become, libbers, which I love the way they use libbers as this like bad word, in this show. And I mean, I don't, it sets my teeth on edge, but it's very, very effective. And Gloria Steinem in that documentary, she goes, she's like, I was the same way. I thought of suffragettes as boring, sexless creatures. And then she said, to do that is one way to stop the movement. So because I was obviously none of those things, maybe I helped to break a false stereotype. So it's this idea that like Gloria Steinem's beauty and her glamour, this is like in the very first episode, Sarah Paulson's character, Alice, and Phyllis are like, the other woman I understand, but Gloria Steinem, she's so pretty. Why is she a feminist sort of thing? And, so this idea that her beauty is being weaponized to sort of help, break, because that's just a way to shut down the movement is to say, oh, well, they're just sad because they can't get a man. And Gloria Steinem's like, oh, I can get so many men. It's fine. I'm fine. Don't worry about me. But that the way in which her beauty and her glamour are weaponized for good, but then also in this episode, you weaponized against her.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think the thing that we see, with Steinem, from her perception from outside of the movement is that kind of frustrated. Well, but I just don't understand why would she want that, you know? And I think that this is really about, and what Friedan tries to do in the debate with Schlafly toward the end of this episode is try to, you know, explain that there's not really a binary that the feminist movement is working with. You know, it's not either or, it's all things. And I think that people on Schlafly's side, like, really have a hard time seeing it that way because they've set up that kind of system for themselves. And I think it's interesting to watch that work as an effective tool, to some extent, but also because it's not absolutist in its ideology. It's not be pretty and not feminist and have men or not, or the up, you know, it's a lot, it's a variance. That kind of vagueness can work against the movement, as we see in this episode.
Another thing to say about, the historical framing of Roe v. Wade, which, you know, we see as a huge step forward for the feminist movement, but it's also in its own odd way, a huge step forward for Schlafly and her movement, because the Roe being passed prompted like evangelicals, church leaders who, you know, before might have wanted to stay out of politics, to rush into the political landscape and start fighting the feminist movement because of Roe v. Wade. And so it's just one of those things that sort of pushed. It's so incredible to watch these echoes of our current, you know, it's just same as it ever was, right? Phyllis sees it as this huge defeat, but it might have in fact been the thing that really helped her, or at least a major thing that really helped her in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there is an important difference to be made between Roe v. Wade and, you know, the hoped for passing of the ERA. You know, we get the update at the top of the episode that 30 out of the 38 required states have ratified it. And, you know, if the 38 do, then it becomes part of the Constitution. Whereas Roe v. Wade was a court decision. And, you know, a lot of people who, on either side have strong feelings about the, it's better to pass things legislatively than have a court decide it, because if a court decides it, then it can always be blamed on this narrow group of 9 people, or 5 people who voted for it, versus it seeming to have the kind of sweeping legislative wave of, you know, a populist wave to get passed. And I think we still, you know, again, with the gay rights, we see that with the gay rights movement where, you know, DOMA was struck down in the courts and thus gay marriage was made, you know, legal around the country. And some people say, but that's tenuous because then all you have to do is get one court to overturn it and then it's over, you know? So I think it's interesting that they set up both of those things, and we know which one lasted thus far, which is Roe, and the one that never even passed, which is the RA. So I think it's presenting a pretty complicated political, you know, strategy, I guess.
The conversation between Betty and her friend, at the beginning here also touches on some swings that the various women involved in the movement took at each other in the press. Betty Friedan did take some swipes at Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug in the press. And then, Nora Ephron wrote this pretty poisonous takedown of Betty Friedan in Esquire. Nora was a columnist in Esquire at the time, and I was able to find that story. It's in a collection of Nora Ephron's work. It's in a Nora Ephron sort of column collection called Crazy Salad: Some Things About Women and Scribble Notes on the Media. And there's a piece she wrote called Miami that she wrote in 1972. That's all about the sort of Betty and Gloria divide. And yes, she does sort of, in her own way, allude to Betty as the Wicked Witch of the West and Gloria as Glinda. And she says this thing, but it's more sympathetic to Betty than I would have guessed having watched this episode. But also, if I were Betty Friedan and I read that, I probably would have the same reaction this Betty in this episode has to it. But there's a line in it where it says, where Nora Ephron writes, "It's her baby, damn it, her movement," speaking of Betty. "It's Betty's baby, damn it, her movement. Is she supposed to sit still and let the beautiful thin lady run off with it?" Which is once again that sort of like Mary Tyler Moore, Rhoda Morgenstern like divide there of these two figures. And also like she describes Betty just being like uncomfortable and on the outside. And Tracy Ullman, I think, does such a good job encapsulating that in this party scene that we see, where she's just like off to the side eating food while watching, you know, these other women have an easier rapport with each other at this party.
Yeah. I you know, Tracy Ullman has long been a favorite of many, including myself, because she would, you know, she had these great sketch shows where she played, you know, an Anna Deavere Smith level of characters, you know, from made up people to real people. She's a genius at, you know, aping tone or cadence or whatever, just to get, you know, at the heart of a person that she's playing. But it's really fun on the occasion that she gets to just see her. And yes, she is playing a real person, but like, she's also just playing a character. I mean, she's acting, you know, like it's a full-fledged, funny, serious kind of thing. And I think she, I mean, not that she needed to rise very far given her stature, but, you know, she meets the occasion, I think, quite well. And it's, I'm really glad that they devoted an episode specifically to her, even though, you know, it's her storyline. It's not the only one in the episode.
Yeah, this, the way that this season is structured in that it highlights various women while still having room for all the other women, I think is really, really masterfully done. And the timing of when to highlight them, you know, like I can just imagine them putting together this season and looking at the timeline and saying, okay, I mean, this debate, basically what Dobby Weller said, the creator, is that the season is structured around the times in which the Schlafly movement and the pro ERA movement sort of touched each other. And, you know, this Betty Phyllis debate is definitely one of those points of contact. And so it makes sense that this is the Betty, episode, but, you know, they're not quite all that easy. There are a few debates that are sort of no brainers as to who to highlight when, but there are other instances like when we have a Bella movement or when moment or when we have a Jill Ruckelshaus moment, et cetera, that are a little bit more, up to creative license, as to when that goes in there. So there's just so much about this show that is so well, perfectly researched and replicated. But one of the things that I know that they really had to generate out of whole cloth is a lot of the Phyllis Schlafly behind the scenes stuff. Because, you know, one of their main sources is actually the Eagle archive, the Phyllis Schlafly archive. So you, like a lot of the video or documents that I've been trying to go look up to see, did this really happen? How did this happen? You can find on the Schlafly archives, actually. But it's this home life stuff with the Schlafly household that I think they really needed to, you know, and for the Friedan household too, I'm sure, but like that they really had to get into. And so when you see this conversation between Phyllis Schlafly and her followers about the John Birch Society and this accusation that she's, you know, sort of, is she racist? You know, what's going on here? You see like some hints of doubt from Sarah Paulson's character, Alice. This they have to sort of generate, but I think it doesn't feel at all blown out of proportion. It feels really, grounded. What do you make of this like John Birch Society and how it touches the Schlafly movement here?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Birch Society stuff, you know, it's an old organization, but it really, my understanding is it really kind of came to power, in a really influential way in the 70s and 80s, and is kind of, Bircherism is now sort of, thought to be the sort of genesis point of the Trump administration, in its, you know, kind of embracing of conspiracy theory. It's heavily anti-government, you know, or at least anti-communism or socialism as they see it, but really anti-federal government. You know, and it's fringy. And I think, you know, I think as it relates to Schlafly and the Stop ERA movement, I understand that, you know, we have a big star attached. She's producing. She's great in it. It's really interesting to see a rounded human version of a sort of, you know, a great, for some people, villain of the recent past. But I will be curious to see how audiences kind of accept that humanizing. You know, in this episode, we see Phyllis both struggle to reconcile the fact that, yes, it's bad PR for some, in some senses, to have these associations with these extreme right groups. But on the other hand, some of her members are part of them and they have power, you know. And I think that what we've seen in the four episodes so far is really about Schlafly, I mean, in the show's version of things, kind of bartering away bits and bits of her principle mm-hmm. in order to mm-hmm. succeed. And I think that's a really interesting thing. At the same time, I think there will be people out there, and maybe I'm one of them to some extent, who are like, you know what? She does not deserve this humanizing treatment because, like, if you really read about her and listen to interviews with her, like, she believed all of this stuff to her bones. You know, this was not about sort of expedience, political expediency. I don't really have an answer either way about like how the show's treating it, but I think it does present an interesting dialogue. And I think is probably why it poses such a, you know, alluring challenge to an actor like Cate Blanchett. Because my hunch is that she's going to, you know, be the villain at the end. But right now they're trying to, I think, successfully calibrate that villainy in a human way.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely about the bedfellows, you know, that she feels like she has to embrace in order to build her coalition, and how that, what that does to erode her, you know, moral high ground. I hear what you're saying, and I have seen that response as well. And I guess my question to that is, like, what is more villainous? And I'm not sure I know the answer. Actually genuinely believing all of this to your bones, or, you know, absorbing messages of hatred and inequity in order to get ahead in life, even if you don't believe in them?
Well, I think, you know, that's a huge question that we have now. You know, I think that for me, one of the prime examples is someone like Ivanka Trump, where it's like, well, no, she's from New York. She went to these schools. There's no way she believes any of this stuff. And it's like, but she has let her father and in administration she works for embrace mm-hmm. them in order to get things done, I guess, or simply to rule, to have power. And so is the kind of complicit stuff, to me, it kind of flattens out to being the same thing, you know, because even if you don't spout out the rhetoric, you're building a foundation on that rhetoric anyway. So you're using it either passively or actively, but either way you're using it.
Something I love that is the genius reflection of this bircherism conversation around Phyllis Schlafly and her members is this pitch meeting at Miss Magazine, where, you know, one member wants to write about Phyllis Schlafly, and Gloria, you know, as her editor, is like, basically, don't feed the trolls, right? Is Gloria's attitude. It's a very familiar one. Like, once again, we can't help but bring parallels to Trump, where I just remember people saying, like, don't take him seriously. It's not worth taking seriously. And then it was like too late, you know, by the time people were taking him seriously, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think,
but you have that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that to me is the most interesting dynamic of this episode in particular, which is this intermovement conflict about, do we recognize Schlafly or not? And they're both sides make a good case. And I think that, you know, because should this person be met on stage and have their beliefs confronted and called out and asked to provide, you know, facts and data and all that stuff? Sure. Yes. But also, unfortunately, one side of thing tends to be better at the jujitsuing than the other, you know, and the right is really good at an provoking attack. And then when they're attacked, saying, oh, well, I mean, look, this person's crazy. Oh, triggered. You're a snowflake, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're a crazy liber or whatever. You know, they're very good at that. And, I think it's just so easy to play into those hands. I mean, I think about, in the current day, someone like Tomi Lahren or Charlie Kirk or Candace Owens, all of these people who should not be famous, should not be these kind of leading lights of a certain sect of the right, far right movement or whatever, but they are partly or largely because on Twitter and elsewhere, people on the left kept going at them and responding to them and raising their profile and raising their profile and raising their profile. And then all of a sudden they were national political celebrities, you know, and I can see Steinem's, you know, in a very different context, very pre-internet, all that. I can see her hesitancy to do exactly that. And at the same time, I can also be sympathetic to Friedan, where it's like, but this person is getting momentum. We have to meet that momentum and confront it. And so I think we don't really know the answer to how to deal with these things. You know, trolls exist, but how do we acknowledge that reality?
Well, I mean, the same thing is true. I was reading a post actually that Damon Lindelof put up on his Instagram about how he was at the Women's March in January in Los Angeles, and there were about 25,000 people participating, according to him. And he was like, meanwhile, he's like, but this was considered this year in 2020. He's like, but this was considered like a light turnout, and it was relative to, you know, 2 years previous or whatever. He was like, meanwhile, About 5,000 people total have been protesting around the country around the, like, way in which we've, you know, the coronavirus has closed down, you know, the country effectively. And they're getting so much more airtime. Like, that if you were just sitting at home, you would think that movement was so much larger than this other movement because of the way the media is covering it, and not just the media, but like social media. And so it is, it's all about perspective. And in putting Phyllis Schlafly up on stage with Betty Friedan, the quote unquote mother of the movement, you're giving her equal stature. And it is a problem. I don't know the right answer. Just like you, I don't think I know the right answer, because I don't know if, like, turning a blind eye until it's too late to fully address the movement is the right move either. That being said, so I was trying to find the if there was any, like, video footage of this debate that happens in Illinois. I saw there's a lot of newspaper coverage, you know, and she, Betty Friedan, did say that thing about burn you at the stake. That is a thing that she said at this debate, but I couldn't find video. But I did find video of Phyllis Schlafly and Betty Friedan debating the ERA on Good Morning America in 1976, so a couple years later. And once again, this is on the Phyllis Schlafly Eagles YouTube page. That's where you find, like, all this stuff. They are the archive. And I have no questions as to why this is on their YouTube page, because Phyllis has the upper hand rhetorically at every turn, and Betty is so flustered, and it's painful to watch, because it's painful to watch a debate where you agree ideologically with the person who is not the more successful debater in this context, you know? And Phyllis Schlafly, one of her like villainous superpowers is like her composure, you know? And so she does this thing, you know, I'm zooming ahead to the debate, but she does this thing at the end of the debate where, you know, Betty loses her cool, and we're all like, oh no, when that happens. And then, you know, Phyllis Schlafly gets to just like simper and say like, well, you just made my point for me about the intemperance of the movie, you know? And it's like, you're like, oh no. And this happens all the time still with people that I admire losing their cool, in debates, in political debates.
And so, it opens, you know, the door for people who, you know, are sort of wishy-washy on things, you know, maybe I agree with the women's movement, but that Friedan has always kind of rankled me, you know? And then all of a sudden you see, I mean, I'm imagining some viewer in the 70s, you see this thing and it's like, oh, well, okay, there you go. Now I have reason. Like, here's concrete proof of why I never liked Betty Friedan. And in sort of finding that proof, you kind of, to some extent, are siding with Schlafly. You know, it becomes a sort of personality thing where, you know, we see that in presidential politics and elsewhere, but like where the personality can oftentimes win out in terms of priority over the actual principle. And I think that, you know, we need look not very far in terms of Hillary Clinton to see how that can manifest itself pretty disastrously on, the political stage.
Absolutely.
I mean, Hillary did win the popular vote. So
she won the popular vote, and she did not lose her cool in anywhere.
No.
Incredibly did not lose her cool in the same way, but it didn't matter in the end. So to go back to that Miss Magazine pitch meeting, though, like, the other thing that happens in that meeting, which is the more perfect mirror of the Bircherism conversation, is this efforts by, Margaret, one of the writers for Miss Magazine, to pitch this article on tokenism. And this is just one of the funniest things. I mean, funniest and depressing things I've ever seen in my life, is this group of white women being like, I'm sorry, what do you mean? And you don't mean us, right? Like, I mean, you don't feel that way here, right? That you're being, and I don't understand what you mean. And it's just like these well-meaning, or maybe not so well-meaning idiots. And Margaret sort of just, you know, slapping a smile on her face and being like, oh no, I didn't mean you, sort of thing. That is what Mrs. America is forcing us to do, right? Is just to acknowledge the not just deficits, but like damaging aspects of a movement that a lot of us largely see as positive, you know?
Well, right. And I think that, you know, that important sort of self-conception of people who, you know, consider themselves on, you know, the right side of politics, especially on the left in terms of identity politics, which I'm not saying that identity politics are bad. I think they are just politics. But like, I think there can be a sense of like, among, you know, a certain generation of, let's say, white feminists or of white gay rights activists or whatever, who are like, really don't like to be confronted with the fact that they are not exactly on the vanguard of right. the movement in a way, you know. Well, what do you mean I have to consider that now? I'm leading the charge here. You know, I'm working at Ms. Magazine. Please don't like, you know, trouble my view of myself with exactly. this yeah. thing, you know what I mean? And I think that that's an interesting, and sad dynamic, that, you know, I think it's good that the show is showing those warts. It's not a hagiography about Steinem or the magazine or Friedan or Bella Abzug. It's being like, well, yeah, they did a lot of good things, but also they were clearly gaping flaws in the fabric of the movement at the time.
So the that's the shot, and then the chaser is this sort of party salon that the character Flo Kennedy, played by the great Niecy Nash, and Margaret Sloan Hunter is the full name of that woman, played by Bria Henderson. And so they're at this party that Flo Kennedy, a real life figure, so is Margaret Sloan Hunter. Flo Kennedy used to throw these Sundays at Flo's, is what she called them, these like gatherings of black women to discuss events, and we see Flo attack flaws in her own movement here, because there are women at this party who are dismissive of Margaret for a couple of reasons. Number one, because she's gay, and number two, this idea that working with white feminists at all is a defeat. I wrote it down. I will forever cherish the phrase horizontal hostility,
mm-hmm.
From Flo, from Niecy Nash. And this is just an incredible scene that once again, it's just like, I just really value this show showing the cracks in every single pocket, every single community of this movement.
I mean, they show that there's not 100% cohesion on the other side, but it's a lot more in lockstep, you know, and, If a movement, you know, it needs many heads, it needs to move into many different directions. It needs to have intersectional considerations, all that stuff. The problem is, the great problem of American politics is that, like, there generally tends to be another side that is much more moving as a monolith. And, that is, I think, why the struggle for all of these good things, equality, civil rights, all that is so difficult. It's because, we're trying to satisfy the right side of things is trying to satisfy as many people as possible, whereas the other side just wants their thing confirmed.
Exactly. And the final chapter of this storyline, sees Flo come to Shirley Chisholm, played by Uzo Dubo, and discuss the idea of founding the National Black Feminist Organization, which she did. There's this funny little moment there where she says, like, oh yeah, 2 years. 2 years, then they'll be over it. The National Black Feminist Organization did, in fact, last from 1973 to 1975. But this is an organization that was founded, quote unquote, to address ourselves to the particular and specific needs of the larger but almost cast aside half of the black race in America, the black woman. And so this is the way in which the movement is schisming, and then the way in which certain members of the movement are trying to hold all those pieces together, because you see Gloria, like, see this flyer with Shirley on it and, you know, think about Margaret and offer her offices. And Margaret's like, yeah, no, I'm good. Thank you very much. I've had my bad experience here. Thank you so much. And all of that. And exactly. It's that kind of, infighting, which happens in almost every leftist movement, that, you know, ultimately winds up hurting us over and over again. This is, again, it's sort of similar to what you were saying with Tracy Ullman, where like Niecy Nash is this incredible comedian and she is capable of just like really broad, high comedy. But here she is, just as she does in her show Claws on TNT, like, given a real role. She's funny, but she's also just like really chewing into it in a way that's extremely satisfying.
Yeah. And she gets to lay out, you know, in a kind of funny aphoristic way, the struggle at the heart of this, and there's no answer for it, but she's like, you know, I know what a difference between a shoe and a lawnmower. Right. They both have uses, but I'm not mistaking one for being the other. Right. And I think, you know, I think that is kind of the complicated way that we have to look at these things, that anyone in a progressive movement has to look at things. There's no perfect answer for who to align with and how to agree and how to compromise and all that stuff. Of course not. You know, I'm much more likely to take that kind of advice from her than I am, you know, maybe from, Friedan, I guess, in this kind of schema of this episode. But anyway, yeah, Niecy Nash is great. And if people want to see more of her beyond this, beyond Claws, beyond Reno 911, which I believe is now going to be on new episodes on Quibi, which is kind of crazy. Watch, Getting On, the amazing, 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 HBO show adapted from a British series. But Niecy Nash is on that and she is really excellent.
Let's hit on Gloria before we wind up the episode with, Betty and Phyllis, in which, you know, this thing happens to Gloria in this episode, just as, you know, Nora Ephron is defending her in Columns and Esquire and Betty is resenting her because, you know, she's so beautiful and adored. That beauty is, you know, being turned back on her, with this lewd pornographic, image of herself that was a real thing that happened. Once again, in the, Steinem documentary, you can see Gloria Steinem talk about it. But basically, Al Goldstein, who was a pornographer, tacked up this poster outside of the Miss offices that had a naked, drawing of Gloria with a bunch of, you know, penises around it. And it was called like Pin the Cock on the Feminist. You know, this is a thing that Gloria talks about, one of many things that happened to her in terms of being attacked for her looks, in a way you don't expect. And, Al Goldstein, I was looking up some information on Al Goldstein and one of his, like, listed as one of his memorable quote unquote quotes, is when asked what he planned to give feminist writer Gloria Steinem for Christmas, he said syphilis. So like, this is the kind of just tremendous human being we're dealing with here.
Uh-huh.
But in that documentary, Gloria, in her own words, Gloria Steinem recalls exactly what Bella Abzug, in this episode says, which is like, your body and my labia or whatever. And in a way that like just made her improbably laugh at a moment when she felt extremely dehumanized and attacked.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, I think that when considering the free speechy, porny kind of people in the 70s, I think my head tends to go to Larry Flint, who, you know, is sort of to some, a hero of the free speech movement. And you don't really seem, I haven't really thought about the people who traded in that kind of smutty humor kind of thing, like really actively working against things like this kind of depicts. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's grim. I mean, but, I think it's a crucial detail in terms of understanding, the ways that Steinem was victimized during this. I mean, maybe it was different from the way other women in the movement were, but, you know, they were getting assailed really from all sides and all ways.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
This is, I think, a great opportunity for us to hear from Rose Byrne. I wanted to start by asking you, you know, I think arguably Gloria Steinem is the most famous or still well-known figure of this movement in this series. How much were you aware of Gloria Steinem and her legacy when you took the role?
Like everyone. I mean, she's this like comic, you know, kind of legendary figure at this point of feminism. Yeah, second wave feminism. And so I knew her. But I was not intimately as informed as I am now. So to answer your question, it was more broad. It was much more the broad strokes that I knew about her. When I started, I said to Darby, where do we begin? Because there's just so much information to read. And I was like, it was a very specific period. I mean, it's this 10-year period that we were focusing on. So that narrowed it down. But she started me off. She sent me this great package of information in this huge PDF.
Was there anything, you know, in that archival information in those interviews, was there anything that proved particularly illuminating to you in terms of being able to access her as more of a human and less of an icon?
Well, I suppose, you know, the scrutiny that you're under in the public eye, I know a little bit about it, but not that much. I'm not, you know, whatever. The scrutiny that she was under was far more of a larger magnitude than I have ever experienced. But I know that the sort of process of it and what it takes from you and what it costs. And but someone like her, which is like, she was married to the movement. My question was always like, what does this cost her? You know, and that's always interesting to me. And that's what I like seeing in a biopic too, because anything that's a puff piece is just dull. You know, you don't want to be it's not interesting to watch. And that's very hard with biopics to, obviously kind of like you want to honor the person, but you also, you want to, you know, understand them and you want them to be complex and flawed. So that was always my interest in it. And but to answer your question, I think the interviews, I honestly just could not believe the amount of, she was just, had a lot of vitriol. She was a polarizing figure, much more than I realized, like really polarizing for women and for men, but for feminists and for anti-feminists, obviously, but within the feminist movement too. Betty Friedan, I mean, she was tough on Gloria. So that was really illuminating to me, thinking that you have to have a pretty thick skin to just get up again at the end of the day and, you know, not fall apart. And she never, she's famously quite unflappable, you know. She has a very different style to the Betty Friedan, to the Bella Abzug, to Phyllis Schlafly. She's far more contained and composed, and her power is a far more sort of subtle, quiet power, but power nonetheless.
You mentioned the Playboy Bunny story. I mean, I think one element of Gloria Steinem, something that the show doesn't shy away from, is, you know, how her personal beauty played into the role she played in the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we hear about in the first episode where they're like, well, I understand why some women are feminists, but why Gloria Steinem? She's so pretty. She could get a man. Why is she a feminist?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, how aware do you feel like she was of her personal beauty and its ability to mean something different to the movement?
Well, from her writing, she doesn't lean into it. She doesn't sort of talk about it that much offhandly, like here or there. She'll comment on someone's comment on her or something like that. But she doesn't dwell on it herself ever, which I think is interesting. She never sort of dedicates a chapter in her book about my this or that or my, you know, what people think of how I look or anything like that. Like she's so talked about like that. And she doesn't give it any weight or time of day. From her own personal writings, from what I read, and I could be wrong, but the research I did, she didn't sort it up. But I love the way Darby deals with it because it's very witty, but it's very, I don't think the show ever objectifies her ever, but the people in the show do, the characters in the show do, so right. It addresses it, but it never is from a male gaze. I don't think it was a part of her story. It was absolutely a part of her journey, was being like an it girl, really, and then becoming the face of this movement and stepping into that. But I think women are just under such more scrutiny. You know, you're too pretty, you're not pretty enough. Constant barrage of scrutiny that you're under as a woman to do with your looks, that men, like, they just don't have that same scrutiny. Like, yeah, I love that comment that Bella Abzug makes at the beginning when she's like, you know, I think JFK cared that he was really handsome, and also, you know, no.
Yeah.
Nobody cared about it. So I think the show is, in a very important way, I think, highlights that double standard.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, her beauty aside, she is, you know, stylishly an icon. There's iconography about her hair, the glasses, the whole thing. It's such an iconic look. For you as a performer, you know, what is something like that Gloria Steinem wig, or, you know, any of these things that are just sort of like iconic to slip into? How does that help you as a performer access the character?
It was essential trying to get, I just kept saying the silhouette, we have to get her silhouette. It's all, because it's just so iconic. The silhouette of the hair, the glasses, the clothing, it's immediately, you know, it's recognizable. And that to me was, I just was obsessed with it. Like, her silhouette, where is it? And how she moved, she was so graceful. She has a background as a dancer. And there's an innate sort of sensuality in Gloria. You know, she's, you know, always, I think, just has that access to the sensualness to her that's very not fabricated or forced. It's just sort of part of her communication and personality, and was trying to sort of capture that as well. So it was hugely important to do that. And I really want to get that. Marcel, who designed my wig, he designed all of Glenn Close's wigs. And I immediately called Glenn. I was like, I have to have Marcel. I got to get his last name for you because he's legendary. And I was like, he doesn't work that much. He lives pretty remotely. So, but he did it for me. So I don't know if I can, you know, we can't do it. We got to get it right. So it was really fun. I think fun. It was so fun to do that. And it informs everything. It informs how you walk and talk and, you know, all of it. It informs all of the performance.
I love the idea of you calling, like, Glenn Close's, you know, a reclusive wig maker to be like, please, I need a Gloria Steinem wig.
And they all knew. They're like, oh, Marcel, yeah, of course, we'll see if he'll do it. You know, like, he's very particular and specific because he's that good. And he did Glenn's wig. I mean, he's done all of her wigs, but he did her wig for Damages, which was just, like, flawless.
So I wanted to ask you, one thing I find really interesting about the depiction of Gloria in this series and her legacy in general is her particular efforts to make sure that the feminist movement is an inclusive movement, particularly to Black women. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of what you discovered in your research on her and what discussions you had around that, those efforts of inclusivity.
And also to lesbian women, which was Betty Friedan's great falling out that she, you know, was quite, you know, her feminism was born of a different era and a different time. So there was always that tension between them. I think ideologically they were very different, and I think that I feel like it's hard. The conversation around Black feminism is still obviously happening and complicated and complex, and we touch on it in the show very specifically. You know, it touches on now that the fact of having intersectionality, which I don't think was really, that is something that Darby sort of addresses, and Gloria's attempts to sort of try to achieve that, and her, you know, failures at that, and her successes at that, and all of it coming from a really idealistic place. Like, she's the most compassionate person, and, you know, she's all about inclusivity, but sometimes it's more complicated than she thinks.
There's this incredible sequence at the end of episode two with the dancing and the remembering of her own experience with abortion earlier in her life. I was wondering if you could talk about filming that sequence and sort of what was in your head as you were putting that together.
It was a lot of fun. You know, the dancing stuff, I had a tap dancing trainer who I relied on heavily up in Toronto. So we spent the better half of 2 months trying to practice that dance. Unlike Gloria, I'm not a trained dancer, and I took every effort in my brain to try to get that right. Initially reading the script, it didn't read like that. That was part of the edit. So when I saw it, that they had sort of interwoven that, those two, the flashback and the present day, was just so moving and so heartbreaking. And I was really taken aback when I watched it. I thought it was really powerful the way they put that together.
Yeah, and I was talking to Davi about how, I mean, you know, it's really striking when you watch this series, of course, how much hasn't changed or progressed in the decades since these conversations were being had. But then there's also just moments of really beautiful triumph that I cried multiple times watching this series. Yeah. Was there anything that was particularly, any moment that was particularly emotional for you to film or see in the finished product?
It was very emotional when we filmed Shirley Chisholm up on stage with all the other nominees. That day took us all aback. We were all in floods of tears. It was very emotional. Yeah. I can't quite describe the feeling. I mean, obviously, it's obviously why, just this incredible image of all these men and this one woman who's also a woman of color. It was really extraordinary, really extraordinary. And also filming the scene at the Houston convention when the lesbian rights is passed on the floor and we start singing We Shall Overcome. That was also very emotional. Yeah, those sort of big group sequences and moments, groundbreaking moments in the decade were really took on a life of their own.
I was talking to Kate about playing Phyllis, and you know, I know it's the job of the performer to find empathy for whoever they're playing, no matter who they're playing. But you know, Kate was saying it was really tough sometimes with Phyllis to figure out how to be on her side. You know, Gloria is obviously an easier person to empathize with, to be on her side. But was there anything that was particularly tough about her for you to access as a performer?
I suppose just trying to find that power within her stillness. You know, she has such a power, but it is within this sort of stillness and within a certain control. And that there's an element of the steeliness there that I feel like that was challenging at times to try to access that in scenes where there was conflict or, but I think that's probably if that's what you're feeling, that's what you're supposed to feel. But, that's my kind of belief anyway as a performer, but that was definitely challenging. Yeah. And also sometimes my hair was just in my face all the time. Challenging as well. I was like, how did she do everything? And also she always had these incredibly long nails. And I was like, how does she do anything with these nails? They'd constantly be breaking and I'd be getting more manicures. And I was like, this is challenging. She's such a groomed person and I'm not that way at all. I'm like basically a tomboy and she's a lady. She's truly quite groomed. And that to me was like such an achievement.
Okay, so the flip side of this you know, trauma for Gloria is, you know, everything that Betty is going through, from this blind date she goes on to encountering her, husband's new wife, et cetera, setting her up to be particularly vulnerable to a personal attack from Phyllis when it comes to debate time. And I love this, like the first date is really good because like Ullman's bringing this like really nervous energy to it, in a way that I, you know, just try to be dazzling and witty, but also nervy in a way that I really like. But I also love the moment that precedes it, which is her picking her dress for the date, and she picks this dress she wore on the Tonight Show. This is an actual, you know, appearance that happened, that Betty Friedan was on the Tonight Show in the 60s. They like got the set exactly right. And so she picked this dress from this time when she felt like at the height of her powers, to wear to what we presume is a fictionalized, blind date. And that just like really, really got me. That juxtaposition.
And I think they played exactly right, in the opening scene, but also this scene, like, and maybe a little bit at the garden party, like she's maybe drinking a little too much. You know, like, right, or not right. Too much, but like she's tightly wound and is finding a quick way to unwind, you know? And it presents something that is, I mean, I think appeals to a sort of reflexive, instinct in a lot of people, which is like a kind of like, oh, the messy woman, like, oh, like, you know, compare her to Schlafly, who is so ordered and pinned up and, you know, everything is so perfect. And Steinem, who has her own sort of free flowy kind of version of, you know, aesthetic perfection.
Elegance.
Yeah. Whereas Friedan and yet, you know, all of that kind of erratic energy, its source is the same source that, you know, helped birth the movement, you know? And so that kind of sad conflict of someone who, you know, bursts something out into the world, but then sort of couldn't, at least in this show's estimation, really find footing in her kind of private life, it's a really interesting portrait of someone who I kind of have only known as the author of that book.
Right, exactly. And it makes you just want to know more and more and more about, or that's my reaction, is I want to know more and more and more about these women. So, you know, on the other side of this debate, Phyllis is preparing, and I was watching another Good Morning America interview with Phyllis and Fred Schlafly, where she said that he taught her everything she knew about debating. So I think that, you know, that gives credence to this behind the scenes, debate prep that they're doing, right? This is something that Schlafly said happened. And, but then everything else there is, of course, fabricated, because we don't know that, you know, Fred, you know, personally attacked her and taught her that that's the best way to win a debate. But that's the lesson she takes. And so, you know, he attacks her about her mother, which we already know is a sensitive point for her. Her mother, who worked extremely hard to give Phyllis what she had. And Cate Blanchett has this incredible post-debate practice scene where she gets her daughter and like throws her into the pool with her and then like cries about it. I don't know. Sometimes I'm watching the show and I'm like, I don't mean to be too effusive, but I'm like, I don't know how I got so lucky as like to get to watch Cate Blanchett do things like this on a weekly basis on a TV show. But, I think this is a tremendously powerful, invented, encapsulation of the internal contradictions of Phyllis.
Well, yeah. And I think that, you know, on the one hand, you obviously, you know, the fact that her mother, who had no help after her, you know, the father left and, you know, basically afforded Phyllis a better life, at least, you know, economically. You can appreciate that and the gumption it took, and you can appreciate that Phyllis appreciates that. At the same time, I think that scene falls short of, which is good, of turning it into this kind of like, oh, well, they're okay. They, you know, we've cracked it open. Like, that's why Phyllis cares. And, you know, we should be easier on it. What the show kind of, I think, really highlights there is that, like, she has a deep appreciation for women who do this, but now that it worked for her, she wants to stop it. you know,
close the door behind
close the door behind her, pull the ladder up, but also in a very blinkered way that I think a lot of conservative ideology does, is assume that you can sort of prescribe a mandate on the world and thus order everything into its perfect shape, you know, which is impossible. You can't do that. The best you can do, and what the progressive side argues for, I think, is to make it as easy for people to live the lives that they are living individually rather than say, well, no pornography and no this and no that and women in the home, because that is my idealized version of how my life worked. And so therefore it must be prescriptive for everybody, you know? So I think you see that, both the internal struggle of Schlafly, while also remembering that her broader politics, like, really shut down that opportunity for a lot of people. And that she doesn't seem to notice that contradiction, or does and doesn't really care, is something I think at root of that character.
Right. It's why she's so fascinating. Or one of the many reasons why she's so fascinating. And maybe that sounds like, as you said earlier, too much, you know, interest to give to a woman who did so much damage to the women's movement. But I do find that internal contradiction incredibly fascinating, and especially the way that Kate Blanchett plays it. Let's hit one more parenting thing with Phyllis before we head to the debate, which is that we get, you know, you had mentioned earlier that you were aware of the fact that Phyllis Schlafly's son was a gay man, and you were wondering if the show would touch on it. This is sort of like our first most meaningful foray into that, in that, you know, John Schlafly is earnestly and emotively playing the organ for his friend Tommy, who's getting married, and it's very clear that John has emotions around that, and Phyllis, and it does not escape Phyllis's notice.
I mean, who among us has not shot moony looks at a man in uniform while playing a pipe organ? It's just a common experience.
Rite of passage there. So, yeah. I mean, that there's more to come on that, but, like, do you have any thoughts on this early, you know?
Well, I think just going back to what I just said is that, like, Phyllis's order is fighting for a sort of ordered, idealized American family life, when right in her own house, there is a deviance from that, you know?
Right.
And I think it'll be interesting to see how she kind of reconciles that with what she's trying to do. I mean, I think that really what this boils down to, I think, in terms of this, you know, emerging portrait of Phyllis Schlafly, is it's really a desire for power and control, and this is the outlet she chose. The irony being that the women's rights movement is trying to empower as many women as possible, you know, and so right. In fighting that, she's finding her own personal power at the expense of all others.
So that brings us to the debate, where, you know, we've got this great pre-debate interaction between Betty and Phyllis in the bathroom, this, like, incredibly awkward moment where Betty comes out of the bathroom and is sort of, like, trying for a second to flirt with Fred. And then Phyllis's sort of, like, on stage eventual evisceration. I mean, like, Betty gets a lot of points on her before this eventual evisceration, but you're just, like, you're so, I feel so much for Betty, because, like, she's fleeing the scene even as there are throngs of young women lining up, like, wanting her autograph. It's not that she's so much more disgrace in her own mind than she is in reality. There's still this huge crowd of people who want to adore her, and thank her. And she's just, you know, overcome with her own perceived failure. And that's just, I mean, it's so well done.
Yeah, it's well done, and it's horrifying, because, again, like we were talking about earlier, it's like, man, this is how they keep doing this. You know, it's just such an effective strategy, you know?
Yeah.
The bait, and then the back away, and then they're like, oh, well, you may not agree with everything I say, but at least I'm not crazy. At least I'm not some mess. You know, I'm not trying to, like, cram anything down your throat. All I'm saying is it would be easier if we just kind of had these rules, you know? And it's so sinister. It's, you know, not that J.K. Rowling is an unimpeachable political voice these days, but, like, I wouldn't be surprised if part of Dolores Umbridge, who is very Thatcher, obviously, Margaret Thatcher, but, like, there's definitely some Schlafly in there, for sure.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, so, and then, like, you know, Betty has this asthma attack in the bathroom, which I see as sort of, like, a mirror of this kind of panic attack that Phyllis had in the pool earlier, you know, and it's just, like, these women are drowning, each on their own side of the fight. And it's just, it's really powerful. And, you know, and then like one of the last things we get is this, I think very fictional, but nice to see healing phone call between Gloria and Betty, where Gloria says, you know, thank you. Your book changed my life. Thank you. That she is, you know, one of the throngs of young women who, you know, that Gloria Steinem wouldn't be Gloria Steinem without Betty Friedan. And that needs to be acknowledged and respected.
It's a carefully worded scene, though, you know, because she says, oh, you know, if I had been there, I would have, which would have been, you know, tame or something, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank you for writing the book. It changed my life. That's all she says. She doesn't say, okay, now going forward, I'm going to listen to you more. Now going forward, we're, you know,
exactly.
She's basically saying, like, person to person on a private nighttime phone call, I hear you and thank you for everything. That said, I'm going to keep doing things my way. So I think, yeah, it's a subtle bit of, you know, it's not a broad sort of like, you're right, I was wrong kind of thing at all.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting to me, the Gloria Steinem of it all, you know, like she got her start. One of the things that put her on the map in the first place is this whole, like, she went undercover as a Playboy bunny, in the Playboy mansion and, or, you know, in the restaurant. I don't know where, but like she
was in the club, the Playboy
expose
club.
Yeah. In the club. Yeah. Yeah. There you go. In the club. And that is something that I think just forever stuck on her and she couldn't shake it. And she was so respected and she fought so hard and she was still undermined her entire life because of that, because of her beauty. And then to watch, you know, Betty feel similar frustrations, not because she's unattractive, because she has her allure, her seductive qualities to her, but just because she's like so, you know, that frenetic energy that we were discussing, that like messiness to her, and the frustration she feels around that. And, you know, it's just to watch all these women struggle, and to see their struggles acknowledged as not lesser than, but, you know, just different struggles that women go through, I think is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this feels like a good time to go to our chat with the great Tracy Ullman. I've been a huge fan of your sketch work for so long, and I'm wondering if there's a difference in the way in which you approach playing a real life character for something like this versus playing it in your sketch work.
No, I really just keep things real. I study very hard to grab the reality of people, and I think doing. I like to be funny, but I'm not a comedian doing an impersonation. And I've worked very hard to be taken seriously as an actress. And it was hard for me to get this part. There were people that really believed I could do this and that that's what I do. And then some people were like, oh, is it like an impersonation? Is it like it's on a certain level? It's not got the heart, it's not that encompasses, it's not the intelligence or the perspective. And that's, you know, that sort of, I'm 60 now, and it was like, wow, that people don't get. You know, I can't be Angela Merkel and, you know, Judi Dench and Theresa May in the last show that I did without really being able to do it and believe in them and understand those people. So, it's harder doing comedy. My God.
That's what everyone says.
You write a scene about a man leaving his wife in a drama. It's a lot harder to make that funny if you do it. So no, I don't see any difference. I'm certainly not playing for laughs. I don't think I ever try to do that too much.
So for Betty specifically, what is your approach in terms of studying her and getting into her skin?
She's a certain type of American that just fascinates me. Her ego and her confidence, and, you know, was something that just shone through to me. And I loved her husky voice. And I love that she's not from New York. And I could really hear that. You know, everyone just say, oh, she sounds like she's from New York. She's like a liberal New York. No, she's not. She's from Peoria. You listen to her. She says, our daughters. You know, you can hear that in there. And she was so passionate. and bohemian. And I think I read The Feminine Mystique when I was in my 20s because I'd read The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, which is really the European precursor to all this. And I just loved the way she always looked like herself. She didn't ever try to dye her hair or... In that scene where she goes on the Carson show in the 60s and says, "Well, my husband, to shut my husband up, I say the word orgasm 10 times in a row." And I love that. I thought to have said that sort of stuff in the early 60s, which just freaked America out. So I loved her bravery. I think she was abrasive. I think she ruffled people's feathers, and she was tough. I think she was a tough woman.
Do you think, you know, what benefit is there in a movement like this to have a Betty and a Gloria?
Well, they were so different, you know. Intellectually and, well, not intellectually, just physically. I mean, it's down with women. It's always physicalities that count for something, unfortunately. And I think Bella Abzug mentions that in the series a lot to you know, Gloria, you're going to walk into a room full of senators and you're going to change their minds because of how you looked, you know. And me and, you know, I've always felt that me and Bella, Betty and Bella, were of a physical type. And, so, and yeah, it took all sorts, and they were so different. And I think Betty was hard on Gloria. She came 10 years after her, and she sort of took over the movement, became the sort of glamorous side of it. And I think Betty had worked long and hard, and she was pissed off when they, you know, she was getting the attention and this, all that hair, you know, and she says that in her episode. And, there's lots of stuff, as you know, on record, you know, of her, them dissing each other and having disagreements and being very cruel to each other. And Nora Ephron's article about Miami.
I read it. I read it.
That was tough on Betty.
It's nasty. It's nasty.
Well, she could be tough, Nora. Mm. You know, she was a brilliant woman. She was hard on her. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like Steinem had, she was like on Steinem's side or something. But
right.
It was tough. I mean, women are tough on each other. You know that. My daughter's in politics and she works. She's had many jobs and she's worked for a charity now. The one job she had when she worked for an all women organization, she was so excited. It's all going to be all women, Mum. What's the time, the toughest time she ever had? She went, oh my God, she said, I wish there was a few men. She went, all women together are a nightmare.
Can't be. I'm curious, you were in your early teens years overlap with, you know, the decade that you're covering on the show. What was your relationship to the movement at that time as an early teen?
I was in England. I was a teenager, I was a dancer. Feminism was a word associated with, you know, fellas laughed at girls that said they were feminine. I got hairy armpits, have you? You know, it was like synonymous with being sexless, humorless, you know, couldn't, it was very hard to be a feminine. I remember Germaine Greer being on TV a lot at that time, and she was kind of sexy. And I think it would have been great to have had Germaine Greer in this series. But feminism was, though I was too young, I was like 16, 17, and but I never felt held back being a girl. I always felt equal to the guys, and I never played the coquette or dressed to please a man. I was always like, you know, I like being female and feminine, but I wasn't angry at men, and I never felt held back in my career by men. I did begin to know, and I always used female writers and production people and all the shows I did. And but I never was humorless about guys or like angry at them, because that doesn't help, you know. Some of them are useless. They don't get women. And some guys are great. They seem to fall into two categories. Some guys are never going to get it. Mm-hmm. And some guys are the best. I was married for 30 years to a wonderful, wonderful man who totally got women and respected women and loved women and had women working for him and was my biggest fan. So I had this amazing marriage, and, you know, he was a great example of just a guy that got women.
Is there a time in your life where you remember, you know, being able to call yourself a feminist, if that's something you call yourself, and it not being, not feeling like such a big deal?
Yeah, I think as I got older and, you know, you develop politically as you get older, it's, and you're more comfortable with who you are and, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't seem to be like, it's not synonymous with hairy armpits and being boring and sexless and
right.
you know, guys saying, oh, you know, you just need a good man type stuff now. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not that way anymore. But I don't want to also be one of those women that's just, you know, sometimes within the business I'm in, it's just like women in film, women in comedy. What's it like to be a woman doing this? What's it like to be a woman writing this?
Right.
And it's like, I want to keep talking about those differences. You know, women's film festivals, women's, you know, it's just like, let's keep everyone joining in. Let's have some fellas around too. Otherwise, you know, what do you want to make just all female TV shows for? That's never been interesting to me. You know, it's, that's not, you know, that's not the way I feel either.
A big question in this episode is whether to ignore Phyllis or whether to confront Phyllis. Mm-hmm. And Betty felt like it was important to debate Phyllis and expose the holes in her logic. And, you know, Gloria's like, let's not give her that air. That's still a question I think that we face all the time. Do you give someone like this the air or not? You know, what's your instinct? What is the right move here?
Yeah, I mean, I think Betty really called it early on Finish Lovely. She figured out she was a threat to them, and she would build her base of housewives, because Betty knew this type of woman more than I think people like Gloria and Bella did, being from like liberal, you know, bubbles in a way, like New York. I think she was from Peoria. She knew these kind of women. She knew their power of organizing. And she didn't want to challenge her. I think probably she took her on to sort of prove to the girls that she could do it. She was still the leader of the movement. And she did give her credence. And then it fell foul of her, because the debate scene, which you see is culmination of the episode I'm in, I read the transcripts of that wasn't televised. Good Morning America debate was. So you can see Betty loses it with Phyllis. Phyllis is very smart. She's eloquent. She has one couple of, you know, talking points, and she sticks to them, and she just frustrated the hell out of Betty. And if you read the transcripts of that debate, it's she's got everyone on her side. It's a wonderful audience for her. It's all those young women who are liberated and educated, and then the very end, you know, she's saying all this good stuff and getting good response, and Phyllis is sort of just sticking to her message but floundering a bit, and then she calls him an Uncle Tom, female Uncle Tom, and I want to burn you at the stake. And what gets remembered from the whole thing, those lines.
Right.
None of the debate that happened before. So Betty had a temper, and she let her get to her, and she didn't handle it very well. But that's a lovely part of the episode. You see her fail, and of course we didn't see the private side of them so much, you know, and then to imagine her going home to her apartment in New York and feeling terrible and knowing she floundered, and then having Gloria call her at the end and saying, you know, you meant a lot to me, and to sympathize with her was, that's the great writer that Darby Waller is, to imagine that that's what might have happened. It's just lovely, women helping other women, and just when you're down, you know, and saying,
right. Well,
to any of us, the woman drives it crazy. But she did recognize the threat of Phyllis before any of them did, but handled it badly herself.
Yeah, I watched that Good Morning America debate, and it was so upsetting to see someone you agree with ideologically still seem to lose a debate, you know.
Yeah.
And frustrating and I'm wondering if behind the scenes, you know, sometimes in projects like this, performers prefer to maintain their on-screen relationship sort of off camera to, you know, not stay fully in character, but I'm wondering what your relationship was like with the other actresses on this show, or did you sort of self-isolate to get sort of Betty's isolation from these women?
I sort of stay in character when I'm dressed up, because it's fun. I like talking to the crew and people sometimes as the people I have become, like, you know,
right.
From the show I do is, you know, I mean, there's nothing more charming than talking to the crew all day as Judi Dench. They love it. they love it. They'd rather I be Judy. No, we got on great as a group of women and actresses. I mean, I was so proud to be, I think I was the last one cast, and they gave me such a tough time casting me. To be in that group was fabulous. And we all lived in Toronto, and we all had visited each other's houses, and we all still get on great now. We've all been Zoom. My first Zoom was with all of them, with Mark, Owen, Rose, and Ari, and Sarah. I wasn't sort of like the one set apart. I mean, like that scene at the barbecue. Mm-hmm. The odd thing was actually when all of us libbers would be on the set, and then we'd see one of the Phyllis women come in for like a wig fitting or a makeup test, and there'd be these like blonde people at the other end of the room. You go, it's a Phyllis person. It was so odd, you know, to us. They were like Stepford wives to us. But that was another lovely part of this show, the way we all got on. I've never worked on a production where there were so many women as the leads, and our director of photography is a woman, and so many female directors and directors of color. And it was fabulous. It was, but not overwhelmingly so, you know, it wasn't like, we're the girls, we're just going to do everything. It wasn't that. It was so, it's one of the greatest, nicest jobs I've ever done, actually. I really enjoyed it.
And my last question to you, and thank you again so much for your time and the work, is do you think the ERA still matters? Because I've heard people, very leftist feminist people, say it doesn't matter anymore. But do you feel like it still matters? Is it something we should still be fighting for?
Yeah, it would be nice to see it completed. It would be nice closure, wouldn't it, after all these years, if Virginia ratifies. And yeah, I mean, it does. Things have changed so much, and the things that it was based on all those years ago aren't quite around anymore. But no, I think it does matter. It's a symbolic thing now. It would be terrific. They fought so hard for it, these women. They went through murders for us. You know, in the generation before, the suffragettes, what they went through. You know, you've got to value. These are hard-won rights. And if we lose them, it's tragic. You know, it's that you just can't take them for granted. You know, the right to choose and everything. It's under threat. And we fought hard for these things, and in this country too. And if it slips away, we can't believe it's going to slip away. And then when it does, you think, oh my goodness, we've got to get back out there again.
Right.
And I don't want to have to do that. We have to treasure what they've achieved for us. So I have such respect for this generation. I really do.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's lovely to talk. I'm glad we figured out the technical stuff.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Worked out the kinks. Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you. Bye. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our discussion of episode 4, which is the first of a few debates. We'll see. Next week is a 4-way debate, Phyllis and Fred and Brenda and Mark, where Phyllis Schlafly and her husband debate sort of the liberal superstar team. And we'll see how that pans out for them. Until then, Richard, where can folks find you?
I'm on Twitter at Rylaws, and I'm covering TV and film at VF.com.
Find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This and at VanityFair.com, and maybe watching some Mary Tyler Moore reruns.
Oh, yeah, good call.
In my free time.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta, name your dinner emergency, we're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now. From PRX.